The war in Ukraine is creating what the UN calls a perfect storm of crises for developing countries. Fighting has driven up global food and fuel prices. 1.7 billion people could go hungry. So, what are the solutions? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has upended the flow of food, fuel, and money around the world. The UN warns the conflict's cascading effects could have an impact on nearly 1.7 billion people. That's because Russia and Ukraine are major food and energy suppliers. They grow much of the wheat, barley, maize, and sunflower oil that developing nations depend on. Prices for these staple items have reached record highs since February when the war began. The conflict and Western sanctions have also disrupted fertilizer exports from Russia and Belarus. Global oil and gas prices are up as well as countries limit transactions with Russia.
The war is supercharging a three-dimensional crisis, food, energy, and finance, that is pummeling some of the world's most vulnerable people, countries, and economies. And all this comes at a time when developing countries are already struggling with a slate of challenges not of their making.
Russia and Ukraine produce about 30% of the world's wheat and barley. The UN says at least 36 nations, including some of the poorest, get the majority of their wheat from them. Food prices are up 34% compared to last year, the highest levels ever recorded by the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. Crude oil prices have risen 60% compared to last year. Russia and Belarus also exported roughly one-fifth of the world's fertilizers, and their prices have more than doubled. All right, let's go ahead and bring in our guests. In Assergi, Italy, Abdulreza Abbasian, a senior food market analyst and a former senior economist with the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. In Johannesburg, Parvin Ngala, a development and humanitarian specialist and a regional director at Oxfam for Horn, East and Central Africa. In London, Chris Weefer, a specialist in emerging markets and chief executive officer of Macro Advisory, a strategic consultancy focused on Russia and Eurasia. A warm welcome to you all, and thanks so much for joining us today on Inside Story. Parvin, let me start with you today. Oxfam published a report this week saying over a quarter of a billion more people could crash into extreme levels of poverty in 2022 because of COVID-19, rising global inequality, and the shock of food price rises supercharged by the war in Ukraine. Just how much more dire could this situation get?
The situation, as we see it, really indeed is becoming more dire. And what I can reference, and I really want to appreciate the opportunity to be able to reflect on this, especially coming from the Horn, Eastern Central Africa region. In Eastern Africa at the moment, we have approximately 30 million people who are facing a hunger crisis because of various factors, one of which is the climate change crisis that cuts across the region. And in this case, we are seeing it manifested in the form of drought in certain countries such as Ethiopia, Somalia, Kenya, but also, you know, other climate change manifestations in the form of floods in South Sudan. So this has a multiplier effect for us on the continent in terms of how it's bearing and featuring in terms of the hunger crisis. And as you talk about the Ukraine crisis, we are seeing it reflected in the form of the food prices as a quick reference. What we do note in Eastern Africa region is at the moment, approximately 90% of the wheat is sourced from Ukraine and Russia. And over the last couple of months, and we know that there's going to be more, we've seen increases in terms of food prices to over 20%. And that is a major concern for us because not only are we seeing climate change, the drought, you know, floods resulting in a hunger crisis, but also the prices, you know, mean that there are even more people who will not have access to the food that they need. The other one you have mentioned indeed is about conflict. You know, we've had a conflict in various parts of the continent, and that becomes a compounding factor for us, not to mention how much the Ukraine crisis also plays into the dynamics.
Chris, the world economy was already in a pretty tough state due to the pandemic. How much worse has the war in Ukraine made things?
Yeah, as you say, the global economy was pretty fragile at the start of this year, starting a recovery from 2 years of the pandemic. And there's absolutely no doubt that this conflict and the consequences of this conflict will add to those pressures and will delay the recovery. And previous speakers already talked about the inflationary pressures, and it's absolutely that those pressures will get worse as we go through this year and probably into next year. So that will have an impact on the global economy. So if you look at energy prices, of course, that are directly impacted by the conflict, the potential that there could be a reduction in, say, Russian oil or gas supplies, that's already led to a 40% increase in the oil price this year, and looks like the sanctions may even press that price higher. But the real impact, I think, on the global economy will be in the area of food. So again, we've already mentioned wheat. That price of wheat is up 45% since the beginning of this year. This is now planting season in Russia, Ukraine. There's no reason to assume any disruption in Russia planting because it's well away from the conflict zone. But the Ukraine planting area is directly in the conflict zone. So if that planting season does not go ahead, and right now it looks like it is not, then we're likely to have minimal exports from Ukraine in terms of wheat and other critical grains at the end of this year. And therefore, you're likely to have shortages, particularly of wheat, therefore leading to flour, as well as some other products later this year. And then the other area, of course, in terms of global food is, of course, Russia, Ukraine, Belarus. This area is a big supplier of fertilizers, of potash, which is used around the world in Asia, in India and Africa. Mm-hmm. They source a lot of potash and fertilizer from Russia, Belarus, Ukraine. And the prices of that product, because of the input prices of gas and energy, will also rise. So no matter how you look at it, we've had a bad start to the year in terms of food inflation. It very much looks like it's going to get worse over the rest of this year and coming into 2023.
Abdulreza, you heard there Parvin and Chris both speak about the fact that even before the war, global food prices were already spiking. There were several factors that caused that. Some of them include the coronavirus pandemic as well as climate change. There's other factors as well. How much has the war in Ukraine exacerbated all of this?
Well, it's very difficult to put a sort of a tag or a price tag or something on that. But obviously, it has raised the premium risk quite substantially. Markets were tight already, and there was no expectation that in a kind of a climate that we were before, that is, prices rising almost every month for the past 12 months, or the previous 12 months before the war started, that we would get ourselves into this sort of a problem. And not just anywhere, but where a lot of the world grain is sourced. If you take, for example, WFP alone, it takes a lot of its grain from Ukraine, and now it has to look for alternative sources or pay higher prices. So basically, what we have today is that it added to the uncertainty about the supply, both short term and near term, and also it brought back again a lot of issues with geopolitics about the shipment, not to mention the infrastructure damage, primarily in Ukraine, which makes it almost impossible to predict when and how much of the Ukraine grain is going to make it to the world market. So all of that means that if you are an importing country, you would need to source somewhere else. You need to go for plan B. Mm-hmm. And that means, you know, you have to rely on good weather this year. The harvests will start soon, hopefully, at least for wheat. Right now, current indications are not so bad, rest of the world. But, you know, we are in the climate change situation, mm-hmm, year after year. So nothing can be certain, right, before it's actually been harvested.
Abdulreza, can I also follow up with you about something that Chris mentioned? He was talking about the issue when it comes to fertilizer now. I mean, it's not just wheat. We have to talk about fertilizer prices that are also spiking. What kind of overall impact is that going to have?
Well, huge. In fact, the fertilizer issue it already made headlines going back to last June. So it's not a new problem. Now you have an additional issue with fertilizer, which is that Russia is the big exporter of it. So obviously we have to see how trade in fertilizer will be affected. And then is the issue of the gas, which you need to import to produce the fertilizer. And that, again, is a huge issue. Now, it definitely adds to the cost. Now, if you are a very efficient producer and you could somehow also benefit from these high prices, you will make sure that your margins are still very healthy. Mm-hmm. You would pay for those high prices, assuming even if you find it. Because mm-hmm. as I said, there is also issue of this supply. So it's just one huge new added uncertainty on top of all mm-hmm. the other things that we had to worry about.
Parvin, I saw you nodding along to what Abdulreza was saying, so I'm going to let you jump in because I want to get your take on this as well. I mean, the more that fertilizer mm-hmm. prices rise, the harder it's going to be to farm, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's true. And I think there's two points that I would highlight with regards to that. One is the issue of price. When we look at the African farmers, you know, more often than not, for instance, in the Eastern Africa region, we're talking about smallholder farmers, many of whom are women. Now, if that's the case, when you're talking about price, who is going to be most impacted? And then it also becomes my second point, what are the mechanisms in terms of being able to support these smallholder farmers to be able to both sustain themselves, but also look at what is their future. So it has that multiplier effect, like we call it, on one hand in terms of immediate needs, but also means on the long term, if they don't have access to the fertilizer, it has an impact on their production and subsequently impacts their livelihood. So the price element is just one part of it, but also looking at the type of communities that we're talking about, many of whom are small-scale farmers that don't have really good coping mechanisms. And as such, we would have to look at what are the mechanisms that might need to be put in place to support them, both on the long term, but also on accessing fertilizer.
Chris, what kind of effect is all of this having on investors? Are they now more wary about the possibility of investing in emerging markets? Is that one of the effects here?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we talked about the impact of people's lives and living in emerging markets and the rising cost of food. But, you know, the development of any emerging market requires capital, it requires investment, and essentially it requires the movement of capital from developed economies into developing economies. And, you know, we saw that slowing down because of coronavirus. Investors in the big developed economies start to become more risk averse, which means that they would put their money somewhere safe, you know, largely in dollar-based assets in developed economies and not taking risks in developing economies. And now this situation will exacerbate that. I think the global concern you talked about, and we're far, we really have no idea in terms of what happens next. Critically, for example, you asked earlier about the impact on global economy. We talked about food, but you know the critical supply is gas. Much of Europe is critically dependent on Russian gas, and no matter about what the political sentiment is, the reality is that Europe simply cannot get that gas from anywhere else, and it certainly would not even have a chance of getting that gas from anywhere else for about 5 or 6 years minimum, and with huge investments. So that's if that gas were to be disrupted, you would have industrial disruption in Europe. You would have a recession in some European countries, and therefore you'd have a global recession. And the reason I mentioned that is because it's a huge uncertainty that investors are aware of. And therefore, it certainly does lead to a reluctance by big investment funds to start taking risks. So long as there is this uncertainty over the global economy, they tend to be more conservative about where they put their money. And unfortunately, that means it usually leads to a reduction in the amount of money mm-hmm. that's available for developing economies, and that makes their situation even worse. So I'm afraid it is something of a perfect storm
right.
that we're now looking at, which started with coronavirus and has been exacerbated with the uncertainty that's now hanging over the Ukraine-Russia conflict. And
Chris,
the situation does not look good.
If I could just follow up with you as well, when it comes to the developing economies, these developing countries that are already struggling with debt financing related to the coronavirus pandemic, I mean, the economic outlook for these countries really couldn't be looking much worse right now, could they?
No, it looks pretty bad. There's unfortunately, if you're an investment strategist looking at a case for investing in most developing economies, it's very hard to see as an asset class. It simply isn't there right now. And then one other factor, of course, is we're now talking about debt default possibility from Russia for technical reasons, but it doesn't matter. Once you start getting a debt default, and we had one last week from Sri Lanka, that also adds to the more conservative stance by investors, and they become a lot more wary of particularly of developing economy risk, and it therefore adds to reluctance to invest. So yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it's very difficult to look at the developing economy asset class right now and say this is a good time to invest. Everything sensible tells you not to and to wait, and unfortunately, that waiting is going to make the situation significantly worse for a lot of developing economies that need capital at this stage, and they won't get it.
Abdulreza, I guess one of the, something else that's really concerning people is even if the war were to end tomorrow, and there's no telling how much longer this war will go on, but even if it were to come to a sudden end, it would still take quite a long time for things to get back to pre-pandemic levels when it comes to global food supply and prices, right?
Frankly, I think we will never go back to the pre-pandemic level. Or let me correct me. In terms of overall supply, you may, but the supplies, probably the supply routes will be very different. I think we need to give market time to channel, to find new routes, I would say, because obviously this is not just a war between Russia and Ukraine. It's unfortunately something like a drawing line. Quite an extensive division of our planet, I guess. So we're going to get a little bit of what we used to have during the Cold War, in a sense. So are we going to have different type of countries, one side or another, friends and foes, and so forth? So I think that eventually trade will sort it all out. But as the other colleague was saying, in terms of we needing time for the changes in Europe to adjust to the new world with gas not coming from Russia or what else, also for food flows. We're going to wait a couple of years, I think, before we settle down with this new world order. And this is most unfortunate, especially for the poorest countries and the developing countries which are struggling. Frankly, I don't know what sort of solution could be presented there, but my wish is that the richer world would just try to not just think about itself as it did in the case of COVID, which is very shameful, but that when it comes to food, they would really start coming up with solid proposals that would at least cushion the poorer countries for the very bumpy years that is going to definitely be ahead of us. To me, the crisis that you're talking about today hasn't even begun. So the real crisis still has to come.
And Abdulreza, I mean, do you have any idea on what it would take to solve any of these crises? Like, what could be done?
Well, had I or would anybody at this point, I think this more than anything else requires a collective measure by all the countries, by all the leaders, including Russia. I think that I've been in this business for 30 years and I have not seen a situation like this confronting at least the food sector, where there are also other crises going on at the same time. So we do need some exceptional, measures in this case. Mm. And I think that when it comes to food, you would expect, especially countries like China, like Russia, to come along with the rest of the world, and at least for developing countries, make no excuses that there will be no interruption in their supplies. And I think that one has to again, not forget the disaster that is happening in humanitarian disasters happening in Ukraine. Mm. That problem has to be resolved quickly, and Ukrainians have to be looked after first and by most. They're not just any people. They're hardworking people, and basically we live on their hard work. Mm. The whole world depends on them. So this is not just a one little war somewhere going on. This is really livelihood of the planet.
Parvin, I saw you reacting to some of what Abdulreza was saying. Did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think one of the things I just want to recognize, and maybe, you know, working with Oxfam and being involved in very many crises across the world, what we've been talking about is the fact that it's not an either or in terms of the attention on the crisis in the world, mm. you know, that it is actually about and, you know. We do recognize at the moment the Ukraine crisis has a significant impact across the globe, but we do also have other crises on the continent. We are talking about Yemen, we have Afghanistan, we've got South Sudan, you know what I'm talking about in the region, in the Eastern Africa region, in terms of the hunger crisis, Western Africa, you know, we've got a Sahel food crisis. So in a sense, it's about also the international community looking at the issues on the globe in terms of how they do have a ripple effect. If there's anything I think all of us learned from the COVID-19 pandemic, it was that we are interconnected. So what does that mean really for us? Mm. On one hand, and maybe just picking up on a point that was being talked about around date, you know, on the African continent, in the Eastern Africa region, at the moment, in terms of servicing debt, because many of our countries, you know, had to look for resources to address, you know, to respond to the COVID pandemic, but also to look at what the recovery efforts could look like. In terms of percentages, over 35% of the tax revenues are going towards debt servicing. We've had a drop, even before the Ukraine crisis, we had a drop of GDP by over 2.7%. So all of that, you know, when you're talking about multiplier effects, is really feeding into more and more crises, and some of which get reflected in the form of conflict. You know, so my point around that actually is that we need to be able to look at it in a systems way.
Right.
What does this mean? What are the lessons we're learning, for example, on food production, the food supply chain? Yes, there's been a mechanisms where we have had a working, you know, food supply system, but clearly there are certain inconsistencies in it, which mean if we have a trigger or a shock on one part, a seemingly small part, it has a, you know, humongous effect. So it's really challenging us also to look again at our mechanisms. And that's why I made the emphasis on the bit around what are we doing, especially on sustainable food systems? Mm. How are we working, especially with small-scale, smallholder farmers that, you know, could close the loop in immediate regional markets? Because we do recognize that the way we've got right now in terms of the food system, while it can very well sustain itself, mm-hmm. small economic shocks, big economic shocks, have a ripple effect.
Parvin, I want to pick up on something you just mentioned in your answer. You were talking about multiplying effects, and you also mentioned the word conflict. And that brings me to my next question. Mm-hmm. We just have about a minute and a half left, but I'm curious to get your perspective. How concerned are you that this perfect storm of variables that the world is dealing with now, which includes climate change, COVID-19 pandemic, and now the war in Ukraine driving up all these prices, how concerned are you that this all threatens to turn into social unrest?
Well, in terms of social unrest, you know, there is that likelihood. You know, we do know of countries, many of the what was called the Arab Spring a couple of years was based on indications such as the prices of food. You know, if you remember what was happening in Tunisia, what was happening in Sudan, those were the triggers for many of our communities. And, you know, we always say, how can I put food, how can I put bread on my table? Those form triggers for many of the conflicts that we have. And so in that sense, even now, people questioning, what is the increase in terms of prices for me to be able to feed my family? What does that mean in terms of looking at options? What are the options? If there are no options, then people take, you know, what we call negative coping mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, while on one hand, you might call it conflict, it is reflected in the form of conflict, but there are other things, people who are missing meals. Mm-hmm. We've got examples of families opting to marry off their young daughters because they want to have less mouths to feed, get some income. So there are negative coping mechanisms that people then adopt, you know, which include conflict, unfortunately, and with resources, whether it is food, whether it is water, you know, gas being the sort of centers of the conflicts.
All right. Well, we have run out of time, so we're going to have to leave the conversation there. Thank you so much to all of our guests, Abdulreza Abbasian, Parvin Ngala, and Chris Weaver. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. For me, Mohammed Jamjoum, and the whole team here in Doha, bye for now.